Hello and welcome to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, General Overseer of the Beyond Shakespeare podcast, which specialises in creating full cast audio adaptations of drama from before 1642, as well as providing background and other production resources so that you can go out and do it yourself. You can support our work and get a say into what we produce by becoming a patron today. Go to www.patreon.com/Beyond Shakespeare. Anyway, today it's the second half of a discussion I had last year with Greg Walker, Professor of English at the University of Edinburgh, about John Heywood, playwright, proverbist, and general all-round interesting chap. Professor Greg Walker has been working on a book about Heywood, hopefully coming up in the future, and has collaborated in a production of Heywood's Play of the Weather. More on that later in the episode. This episode covers the latter part of Heywood's career, from around 1533 onwards, from when his playwriting seemingly falls to the wayside and his published writing focuses on proverbs and poetry in various forms. It's the Reformation, and Heywood has to navigate a fair few religious political problems. You should be able to listen to this without doing so, but part one is never a bad place to prepare for part two. So, musician, singer, playwright John Heywood, after a good stint in the late 1520s to the early 1530s, wrote a number of plays, what we've recorded for the podcast. Witty and Witless, Gentleness and Ability, John John, The Pardoner and the Friar, The Four Ps, A Play of Love, and The Play of the Weather, coming soon. Go on, have a listen. So, following this burst of drama, what next for our playwright? Well, let's find out.
Talking more generally about his career then, so we're hitting the 1530s, we have all these plays, he's quite busy. Mm-hmm. How's his career going, and how does it go, shall we say, post-Reformation?
Yes, it's a tricky line to walk. I mean, there are a couple of really interesting moments. He has this kind of, well, I was going to say meteoric, but it's clearly not, modestly successful. The 1520s, you know, his career is developing, he's got a young family. He's moved to London. He's doing well. 1528, he suddenly, for some reason, stops being paid a salary at court and gets a pension, which is fine, but isn't as good as what he had before. And at that point, he starts seriously writing plays at the same time, I think. I don't think they're unconnected. Then you have the cataclysm of 1533, 1534. All the plays are printed in that period. Then William Rastell stops printing. John Rastell has had a religious conversion and is now a kind of earnest evangelical legal reformer. Mm. So all the institutional support that Heywood had to write and perform plays is taken away. And I suppose it's no accident that he stops, as far as we know, writing new material then. And he gravitates back towards being a musician and singer, probably at St. Paul's, maybe at a parish church called St. Mary at Hill. And he starts writing songs, but they're very politically engaged songs. They're all about merriness and the resistance of malice and stopping gossip and ill will. And if you read that in the context of the legislation of the 1530s, which, you know, obviously Thomas More has become estranged from Henry quite rapidly and is arrested and interrogated for refusing to sign the Oath of Supremacy and the Oath of Succession. And then the Treason Act comes in, which says that if you speak maliciously against the king, then you're a traitor. So I think the way Moore articulates that is to deny that he is malicious. You know, he says, I'm full of goodwill. I think no ill of anyone. I speak no ill of anyone. I feel no ill will to anyone. I pray for the king daily. And I think Heywood is part of that. You know, he's writing songs about how there is no malice. There is no, you know, that the only opposition to the Christian life is ill will. And clearly he's cheering himself up and his friends and his allies in a world where they're ringed around with hostility because they're Catholic. They're against the supremacy broadly, and you know they see the Reformation as extraordinarily threatening. But Heywood's brilliant coup is that he never allows that to ostracize him. He still has an entree at court, clearly.
Yes,
he's rewarded by the king in 1533 when More has resigned.
Yes, he seems to be genuinely liked.
Yes.
And he seems a very jovial figure. It's that sense of the lightness of his touch when it comes to ideas is that there's a reasonableness to his positions and a willingness to sort of accept that other people's opinions are you know, are valid or have some weight, and you know, let's have the debate. Whereas
society is diverse, he always says, and recognizing that is the first step forward.
Whereas the society around him is becoming much more polarized and much harder. And you know, this is why I always find Hayward interesting in comparison with Bale.
Yes.
You cannot find more different a person.
Yeah. I've got a section on that in the book. why Hayward is not Bale and vice versa.
Yes. I mean, there's a play in that of the parallel lives, because they both live a long time. They both live through this swinging pendulum of religious practice. And and survive in very, very different ways. And that's sort of why one of my sort of producer's choice plans for the future is doing some low level work on Bale. I'm not doing a quite the same sort of work as with Hayward. I'm just sort of doing the groundwork really, rather than full productions. You know, in the sense, I'm much more interested in Bale as a person than I am to some degree his work. Though that is shifting, actually.
The work is really interesting.
I think his Temptations fantastic. I hadn't appreciated how good that was as a piece of drama. You know, proper modern drama as well, in that sense, rather than a piece of theatre presented at someone. It's quite deep psychology going on in there that I had never appreciated before. And similar, much more problematic thoughts about John Baptist's preachings, which is harder, but again a very interesting play to unpack. But we're going off topic.
That's another one. Yes, we'll do that.
So Hayward's life, you know, at court, around court, how does the changing, well, not just religious world, but also the changing monarchs, how does his relationship with them work over time? I think we're starting
counterintuitively in a way, which is interesting. I mean, I assumed naively at the start that he would struggle as the Reformation became more severe and radical. He would become more and more alienated. The opposite is true. His great moment of crisis was in 1542, when he was arrested, interrogated, and tried for treason because he denied the supremacy. And I think it was possible for him, partly because of his reputation, partly because he wasn't a priest, wasn't formally a teacher. He was never actually put to the oath like priests and clergy were, and people in high office. So he could just keep his head down. And, you know, if they said, is the king the supreme head of the church, he'd say, whoa, and walk off. And he would accept that. But suddenly, with this, the plot called the Prebendary's Plot in Kent, there was a huge investigation into whether there was a kind of Catholic conspiracy against Cranmer. All the Moore family seemed to have been interrogated. And Hayward, presumably at one of his interrogations, was asked, will you swear the oath of supremacy? And he denied it. He said, no, I won't. And so was arrested and was literally dragged to the scaffold and was made to watch members of his family being hanged, drawn and quartered. And then was released because he obviously had at some point abjured and accepted the supremacy. But and a lot of previous writers have said, oh, he must have been involved in the conspiracy. He must have been actively plotting. I don't think he was. I just think it was a moment of crisis for him, because what he'd hitherto avoided having to choose, suddenly he was confronted with. And first of all, you know, remembering Thomas More and his stand against all these things for which he was martyred, he denied it and stood by his principles, and then at some point conceded. And almost immediately afterwards, he was welcomed back at court. And that's when Cranmer invited him to do this play on the parts of man. Cromwell had him write a play.
Yes, I was.
And then suddenly, oh, go on, sorry.
Yeah, no. That's what I find fascinating, is that we have these commissions from people you'd think from a very
all
different
not
circle.
To be interested, yes.
You know, his old circle is dead or dying, and this new circle is welcoming him in.
I mean, it may be because he worked with children, and you know, Edward the sixth, people around Edward thought that that's the kind of thing he would like. So he becomes quite a significant figure at the court, and with the Duke of Northumberland and Edward, and you know, the anecdotes about him being witty around the court. And dropping bon mot into conversations and things, which don't survive for Henry's reign. weirdly. So he was probably more successful in the reign of Edward than he was before. And, you know, this was at the point when the Reformation was at its most radical. Yes. And even in practical terms, you know, musicianship was being driven out of the church. So churches were destroying their organs, and plain chant and polyphony were being driven out in favour of psalm singing. So he could not but have hated it. But there he was at court. And then when Mary succeeded, obviously he was delighted because he'd stuck loyally with her through the 30s and 40s and performed for her and wrote a very powerful celebration of her uniqueness and her plight as a kind of ostracized Catholic daughter of the king who'd been, you know, had her title of princess taken away from her. But at her accession, you know, he writes these rather lame poems of celebration. You know, his muse had deserted him at this point, I think. It was when he was at one step away from the regime, writing slightly critical, whimsical, satirical things, that he was at his best. So if you read "The Eagle's Bird Has Spread His Wings," you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. "The eagle's bird hath spread his wings, and from far off hath taken flight, in which mean way, by no leverings, on bough or branch this bird would light. Till on the rose, both red and white, he lighteth now most lovingly, and thereto most behovingly. The month ensuing, next to June, this bird this flower full perch doth take, rejoicingly himself to prune. He rouseth ripely to awake upon this perch to those his mates. So meet a match in parentage, so meet a match in dignity, so meet a match in patronage, so meet match in benignity, so matched from all malignity. As, thanks to God given for the same, Selden hath been seen, thus saith the fame. Thou, in conjoining of these twain, such sacred solemn solemnity, such fair in feast to entertain, such notable nobility, such honour with such honesty, such joy, all these to plat in plot. Plat them who can, for I cannot."
Dire celebration of Mary's wedding to Philip II.
We're sort of, I think we are, in around about the period, because he's still, he's being published, but he's not being published for plays. Are we about the right time for Spider on the Fly and things like that?
I mean, but
which I have not got to grips with. I'm going to be entirely honest, I've vaguely looked at it.
Well, for The Nation, I have read it in its entirety and written a chapter on it. It's the oddest thing that he did, but I think it's a product of well, for better or worse, it's a product of the early reign of Mary. It's clearly this bizarre, allegorical, sprawling, enormous poem talking about a legal dispute between a spider and a fly. And
paper like actually quite a good idea, but from my impression of it, it does sort of lose its thread, shall we say.
Yeah. Well, it bears the history of its own extraordinarily lengthy life, I think. I mean, it seems to me fairly obvious that he started it in the mid-1520s, and it was a satire of lawyers' arguments. You know, it's like the dialogues and the early interludes. It's about arguing, and it starts off with this kind of engaging conceit. Well, if a fly ended up in a spider's web, what crime would he have committed? Would it be trespass? Would it be damage? Would it be burglary? And by what legal precedent could the spider eat him? And he indulges himself with this for 3,000 lines, 4,000 lines. I mean, half the poem is this dispute. Hilarious, no doubt, for lawyers, but of absolutely no interest to the rest of humanity at all, as far as I can tell. I mean, and he then put it aside for you know, 15 years or more. And then suddenly, clearly, he was energized and excited by the series of rebellions in 1549 against Edward's reign, particularly the ones in Norfolk. And he revisits the story and turns it into a war between spiders and flies, in which the insects and the arachnids, if I got that right, they behave in the ways that the rebels behaved in 1549. And that has almost no connection at all to the earlier gentle satire of legal stuff. And then he thinks, oh, obviously this is rubbish, I'll put this aside again. And then when Mary's reign comes back, you know, presumably he's popular with printers again. They say, what do you got, John?
Yes, I was thinking that.
Wait a minute, there's my Jazz Odyssey period that I can revisit, like Spinal Tap, and reinvent this thing. I'll make it into an allegory of Mary's accession, which he then does by having you've had this war between spiders and flies, which everyone then sort of sort of half forget, and you go back to the original fly, and Mary, the maid, comes in and treads on the web and kills the spider. And then this becomes an allegory for Mary's accession and, you know, crushing religious dispute by attacking her enemies, but mercifully. So, you know, he has a chance to rather sort of awkwardly do this dance around religious persecution. Yes, she's killed the spider and that was necessary, but it was only one spider and she killed him gently. So he's sort of saying, well, perhaps, you know, we could restore Catholicism without all the burning, please. But it's a mess. You know, it's a three-part structure in which the three parts have very tenuous connection to each other.
I mean, there's something quite interesting about it, and it's there's hearing that as an exposition of how and why it comes about makes it more interesting in my mind. I still think it's very low down my list of priorities. I mean, I'd love to, in a sense, I'd love to do a sort of complete Haywood. I think I'm sticking with the complete plays of Haywood.
Yeah, I couldn't recommend it.
No,
Jeeves, I couldn't recommend it, sir. It's not. I mean, you can imagine sort of conversations between Haywood and his putative printers. I mean, one is about John, and John, and Sir John. And you think, you know, well, John, is that the best title we could go with here?
Yes.
And the other one is, okay, so this is about a spider, is it? And a fly. Mm. And it's over 10,000 lines long. And you want how many woodcuts? And how many people are going to buy this, do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I think the woodcuts are put in to make it more readable.
But that must have cost a fortune.
Oh, I'm sure they did, but you know, it's like one of those albums that they spend 10 years working on and it's impossible for it to recoup its costs. Yeah.
So we'll give it a triple gatefold sleeve.
Yes. It's not unknown. I mean,
but I'm sure he must have paid the printer. I mean, it's if anything is a vanity publication, it's The Spider and the Fly.
I mean, how old how old would he have been by that point in 50s?
Oh gosh, 60s? Well, he'd be in his late. Let's get this right. 1550, something like that. So he would have been in his 60s, coming up to around 60 when, you know, a gentleman's midlife crisis is here.
Well, I mean,
so rather than buy a horse with go faster stripes, he goes, I'm going to publish The Spider and the Fly.
And when was he? When were his various proverbs and texts published in relation to this?
Well, this is, I mean, they're the great success story.
Yeah.
I mean, he hit upon that just, you know, in the couple of years after his abjuration, you know, when he was rehabilitated, there was a kind of clearly a mood that people were willing to print his early plays again. So a couple of those were brought out in a second edition. Probably this was when Witty and Witless was copied into the manuscript where we have it now. And then he did the Dialogue of Proverbs, which, you know, was initially a kind of standalone project, which is, I mean, that may be worth trying to do.
I have to say, it sort of works. I mean, I would like to do a test run with bits of it with some actors, but I think there might be legs on that. It's interesting.
And it's interesting you said Shaggy Dog Story earlier.
Mm.
Because, you know, the joke of the Dialogue of Proverbs, I think, is it's a Shaggy Dog story.
Yes.
The narrator is talking to this young man who can't decide whether he wants to marry a young, beautiful woman he says he's in love with or an old, ugly, rich widow. And so the narrator says, well, I'm glad you come to me because, as you know, I'm an aficionado of the English proverb. And I think we can find a few that will help you make your mind up.
Yes.
4,000 or 5,000 lines later, after he's thrown 700 proverbs at the problem, he says, well, maybe I shouldn't marry either of them after all.
Yes.
Boom, boom.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, that's that thing of not coming to a definite conclusion is quite characteristic of Haywood.
And there are those wonderful moments when you have no idea which narrative you're in, because he says, well, let me tell you about my neighbour, who also married in a rather unfortunate way. And in the middle of the story about the neighbour, the neighbour meets someone else who says, that's funny, because my uncle married rather like you. And they're all kind of telling these proverbial lessons about, you know, how you should or shouldn't marry someone you love. And there's kind of nested story within nested story. And it could never end. I mean, it would happily have gone on forever.
And then
the guy says, enough. Well, I made my mind up. I'm marrying neither of them.
And the thing is, it does end, and it's not desperately long as a text.
But it does feel long.
Yes, but in terms of material and saying, okay, we don't have to do all of it, you know, what can we do with it? It's definitely a text where I felt that there's something could be done with this. Where there's plenty of other texts that I'm working with where I'm going, really don't think I can. So,
but it was obviously phenomenally successful because the commission came back, can you do something else? So then he was doing the 100 Proverbs, the 200 epigrams on Proverbs, the 300 epigrams on Proverbs. You know, almost every, you know, 3 or 4 years, he brought out another edition of these Proverbs.
Yes.
Which... You know, they're very different to, you know, they're not part of that more humanist circle. They're London Proverbs, I think. You know, they're written for a popular readership. And he had the distinction of having a, you know, his complete works published, you know, at a time when only Thomas More had had his complete works published before then. But it's all the Proverbs. It's not the plays. No. They didn't want those.
No. We are approaching the reign of Elizabeth, I think, with a rate of knots.
Yep, it's coming into view.
It is coming into view. So how does his career progress into Elizabeth, and obviously where does he end up living? And how does that come into being?
I mean, Mary's death must have been an absolute cataclysm for him. You know, he'd seen all the things he loved brought back. You know, Catholicism was restored. There had been colossal violence bringing it about, which he was clearly uncomfortable about. But at least, you know, we were back in the world of the 1520s with a kind of Catholic dispensation. And then Mary died, and Cardinal Pole died on the same day, and that dream is snatched away again. And Elizabeth very quickly establishes that, you know, we're not going to have a kind of Catholicism without the Pope again. It's going to be a tentative but nonetheless Protestant Reformation. And I think Heywood tried to live with that. I mean, he performed at court for Elizabeth, published one final edition of the epigrams, and so was kind of business as usual for a while, but was clearly beginning to worry. A lot of his relatives had fled back to the Catholic Netherlands or to Italy. His sons were beginning to explore a vocation with the Jesuits. You know, his position was increasingly precarious. And the Jane Flynn, the music scholar, has discovered a new Heywood poem.
Oh.
Which is brilliant. I mean, wonderful discovery. Called When All That Is to Was Is Brought, you know, which is about looking back on the past and, you know, the end of your tenure. And it's essentially a poem about, do I stay or do I go? It's presented as a text of someone on the brink of death, but it's actually a text about someone on the brink of exile, telling his family that, you know, we must balance our duties to the king, to the prince, with our duties to God. And it's about flight and exile and what you lose. And within a year and a half, he'd fled with Ellis, his elder son, to the Catholic Netherlands and was living there and lived there for the rest of his life. Clearly, it wasn't possible again to reconcile himself with a regime that he wasn't in step with. And clearly, he was going back to his earlier recantation, which, as Jane Flynn shows, was suddenly brought to prominence again because Fox's first edition of his Book of Martyrs printed Heywood's recantation speech in its entirety. So the kind of cringing, compromising collapse that he had to voice about, you know, how he'd been wrong about everything and the king had been merciful was there in print for everyone to read.
Moreover, here afore God and you, good Christian people, I do utterly and with all my heart recant and revoke all mine aforesaid erroneous and traitorous opinions. And as my conscience now doth force, I protest that, even with my heart, I firmly think and undoubtedly believe that the Bishop of Rome neither now hath, nor at any time hath had or can have, by any law of God or man, any more authority without the precinct of his own country about him than any other bishop hath within his own diocese. Whereby I assuredly take the abolishing of the pretensed and usurped power or authority of the Bishop of Rome out of this realm, to be done justly and truly by the law of God.
And that may well have helped to tip him into thinking, you know, I will not do that again. So rather than defy the prince, because he was clearly patriotic and loyal, or defy God, he chose the middle way, which was to run away, to flee. And he spent the rest of his life in the Netherlands trying to get enough money from his properties in England to live on. And because he was an exile, the various legislation was brought out confiscating the lands of people who wouldn't come back despite being invited.
Yes, because he was... Elizabeth did say he could come back, or invited him to come back, or something like that. Am I getting that wrong?
I mean, clearly he wasn't. You know, there were people who'd gone abroad and were traitors.
Yes.
And technically, Heywood was a traitor, but they didn't think of him in the same way. So Thomas Wilson, the author, was a servant of Lord Burghley, who was doing a kind of tour of the Netherlands, talking to sort of soft exiles, trying to get them to come back. And he went to see Hayward, you know, said, look, the Queen is minded not to ask quite polite, you know, private questions of a man's conscience. Just come back. But he didn't. He couldn't. Mm. And so he played for time and, you know, wrote letters to Burghley saying, you know, I'm very old, you know. I'm very old. I'm in my early 80s. Can't hear as well as I could. Boat trip, bit of a challenge. Please, could you look after my family back in England? And what about some of my revenues? And remarkably, Burghley said, I'll look into it. And he did. And he got Hayward some of the money that he was owed. So they didn't think of him as an enemy or a danger, I think. But he just couldn't come back.
No. And was there any more printing or anything else in during that period of exile? Or, I mean, presumably,
yeah,
printing,
I mean,
would continue. He wouldn't got anything from it, no.
Sadly not. But, the works were reprinted several times during that period. And even some of the plays were 4P, for instance, was printed again. And so people remembered him. And it's interesting that Wilson, in his letters back to Burghley, says, you know, I saw old Hayward. You know, clearly, they still remember him as, you know, an entertainer of a previous generation who they're sort of interested to see what he's doing. A sort of Bruce Forsyth figure in exile.
It is this extraordinarily long life. I mean, think of many of the other people who worked in the theatre in, you know, throughout the early modern period, and they don't tend to live desperately long.
No. And Hayward outlived everyone. I mean, it's a very sad ending, in fact, because, you know, not only did all of his own generation die before him, but he lost all of his son-in-laws. All three of his son-in-laws died before him. Mm. And his oldest son, Ellis, died before him too. So it must have been a desperately lonely life. I mean, we don't know what his Dutch was like, but he lived for 15 years in Mechelen and then in Antwerp and then finally in Louvain. As the Dutch revolt and the Dutch Reformation was kind of swirling about him, driven from one house to another. Eventually they let him into the House of Jesuits to live with his son in Antwerp. But then that was sacked and he was they fled from there. Must have been a terrible life for someone in their late 70s, early 80s in those kind of conditions. But and so he finally died in Louvain after fleeing from Antwerp. But died with a jest on his lips, we hear.
Ah.
So kept his sense of humour to the last.
His son Jasper obviously goes on to do some writing as well in the theatrical vein.
Indeed.
Do we know much about their relationship or anything about them in conjunction?
We know some things. I mean, it's interesting that it was Ellis who Hayward clearly placed his trust in. It was Ellis who went into exile with him. Jasper had already gone off to become a Jesuit and had gone to Dillingen in Bavaria and been accepted into the order, having given up this kind of glittering career as a translator of Seneca at Oxford. And then Ellis up sticks and heads off for Munich and unexpectedly turns up and says to Jasper, I'd like to be a Jesuit too, can you sort it? And so they both became Jesuits, leaving poor old Hayward in the Netherlands for 3 or 4 years on his own. Jasper had a rather awkward career, I think. You know, he was very disputatious, unlike his dad, who was, Mr. Geniality. Hayward was always having arguments with people, and the masters of various Jesuit houses were kind of pulling their hair out at him. And then he was the one that came back to England as part of the kind of Jesuit mission to reconvert England under Elizabeth, and was arrested and tortured. But again, there was a kind of Hayward mystique, I think, about them all. People liked the Haywards. So Northumberland's son, ultra-Protestant aristocrat, visited Jasper Hayward in prison and said, you know, is there anything you'd like? Can I help you out at all? You know, to a Jesuit traitor who's not of your class. I mean, that's quite a dramatic gesture. Because the two had been at school together and, you know, their dads knew each other. Northumberland and Hayward had got on. And Jasper Hayward, rather like his dad, says, well, the only two things I've got in this prison cell are hay and wood. Ta-da! So, you know, there's a chip on the old lame jokes block.
Yeah.
Even with Ellis and Jasper.
Not that Jasper, I think, had many opportunities to throw that into Senecan tragedy.
No, he chose his art form well, I think, for a troubled and difficult man.
Yes.
Tragedy of blood was the thing.
Yes, I do look forward to the time when we actually get round to, because I think we will get round to doing the Senecan tragedies at some point.
I really would like to.
I mean, I'm not entirely my own master, because we've sort of opened it out to our patrons actually choose our main texts from now on. So if you're a patron, then you get to vote what we produce. But I still have producer's choice, and I still do the sort of littler stuff off my own bat. So if I can persuade the world that a season of Senecan tragedy would be
post-Brexit jolly up.
Yes. Something to cheer everybody. Cheer everybody's soul.
Lift the national morale.
Absolutely. We sort of skirted over weather to some degree, which is silly because you've actually worked with the text and in a very active way. Tell me about the play of the weather as a project
Well, a wonderful opportunity, which we didn't really expect when we applied for the chance to put it on at Hampton Court Palace in the Great Hall. But the money came through, thanks to the AHRC, so we doffed our caps and got on with it. And it was we learnt a lot about that play, I think, from producing it. We saw very quickly that it was about the engagement with the audience that made it so. I mean, what you couldn't do, this is the classic dilemma of all attempts to kind of reproduce authentic performances of things, is you can't make an audience feel the way an audience felt in the 16th century. So if Henry VIII had been there, that would have been the story. And without actually having someone with the same power and cultural kind of magnetism as Henry VIII in the room, you couldn't see why it was so daring for Heywood to have people joking about royal marriage or having extra heads that you didn't think you knew about. You know, in one context, that play is about is tickling Hitler. You know, it's how brave can you be with seemingly hardenless jokes around a center of power that is volatile and hostile. We couldn't do that. You know, we thought, do we try and get someone important in the audience so that people are half watching how they're watching at the same time as they're reacting? You know, because obviously if Henry VIII or Cromwell or someone was in the room, then you would be acutely conscious of whether you were laughing in the wrong place or not laughing in the right place or all those things. So we couldn't do that. What we did find, and it was kind of serendipitous because Tom Betteridge, my collaborator, just said, oh, women on the left, men on the right, as people were going in for the first performance, which we hadn't even considered up until that point. And so suddenly what you got was men and women very conscious of being watched by the other sex, reacting to jokes about gender and sex and social privilege. And that was very revealing. You know, when the laundress and the gentlewoman were talking about the flaws of male authority or what it means to be a pampered gentlewoman or a hard-working artisan, you could see people nodding or not nodding or getting cross, and you were aware of yourself being looked at. And it was a linkling, at least, of what it means to be watched as a watcher of theatre in a community of people you know. And, you know, how you respond to Mary Report or Jupiter or The Gentlewoman is something you will have to own up to and live with tomorrow and the next day, because the community that watched you watch the play is the community you live and work in. And you would never have got that, I think, just from reading the script.
No, and I find that with every play, you know, you can use your imagination to a point, but then the physical reality, I mean, even when we're not particularly physical with it, does change, you know, does throw in layers that you just wouldn't see, or you frequently don't. I mean, it's not that you couldn't, it's just you don't. I mean, Play of the Weather, I mean, in many ways, I'm really glad in the sense that it has been done in a relatively straightforward way, if that means, you know, performance, because so much of that I don't think is going to translate for audio. And so it gives me a certain license to be a little more cruel to the text. It's all of those sides, it's just going, how many of them can work? Some of them can, because there's that sense of, you know, that initial argument between gods at the top. You know, we can have gods going, oi, and reacting to that initial proposition. Yeah. So having that sort of more raucous room, we can generate that artificially. Whether it works or not, I don't know.
I mean, that's one of the most daring things about the play, I think. You know, if you're playing it at the royal court and regal authority comes over as just being a bit shabby and Ruritanian and not very convincing. I mean, that's the most daring, you know, to make royal authority seem slightly unimpressive, slightly overreaching.
Yes.
In the context of a king who is dramatically overreaching.
Yes, and it's the nature of the fawning nature of the supplicants and who come in. And I also just love the fact that Jupiter's, you know, initially not very impressed with Mary report, but once he's sort of done it a couple of times, and it keeps coming. Look, I gave you do it. I'm behind the curtain. Leave me alone. Yep. Yes. Just get on with the job. And he sort of gets really quite annoyed. Yep.
What do you want now?
Yeah, come on. And just that relationship is really fun. That's really quite fun to play with. Any final thoughts? I think is on Haywood, or for that matter.
Well, I mean, I think it's wonderful that he's getting his entire canon of theatre re-looked at and reinvented. So, I mean, I think this is a wonderful moment for Haywood. And if I can sell the enormous and vastly overpriced biography on the strength of the audio canon, etc., then I'll be deeply grateful.
Well, remember to at us in and on Twitter when it comes out, and we will retweet and republish and, you know, put out as many plaudits for its existence as we can.
Marvellous. You know, I mean, I'll double my reader, yeah. I think, if that is the case.
Well, I mean, what I'm hoping, and this is very tenuous, is that try and persuade people off the back of what we've done is to try and find some other people who might want to stage their own version. I'm trying to package Haywood as a fringe possibility for people.
That would be good, yes. And keep me in touch.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, is just try and build the enthusiasm and just the relative ease of doing him. You know, once you get into it, I think that's the initial approach. I mean, Play of Love, you read it on the page and just simply you can't read it because the names of the characters just mean you lose. It's mind-numbingly painful. But I think once someone's got a routine, then we've got a chance. So that's sort of my, once it's all done and online, is actually trying to persuade somebody else to do it.
Brilliant. Absolutely.
That's the
all
game.
All power to that.
Well, the challenge is, can you do it better than we did?
Well, just do it different. Keep doing it.
Yeah.
There's not just one way to do Haywood. I mean, if we think, you know, he's done, then that's it. But he's not. It's been started again.
Well, thank you very much again.
Well, my pleasure, and thank you. And good luck.
And I'd like to thank Professor Greg Walker for talking with me last year. The extract from The Eagle's Bird was read by Adam Thurkettle. And we end the podcast on a cheerful note with a full reading of John Haywood's Recantation, as transcribed in Fox's Acts and Monuments, performed by Hugh Weller-Poley. Enjoy.
I am come hither at this time, good people, willing and of my own suit, desirous to show and declare unto you, briefly, first of all, the great and inestimable clemency and mercifulness of our most sovereign and redoubted prince, the King's Majesty, which His Highness hath most graciously used towards me, a wretch, most justly and worthily condemned to die for my manifold and outrageous offences, heinously and traitorously committed against His Majesty and His laws. For whereas His Majesty's supremacy hath so often been opened unto me, both by writing and speaking, if I had grace, either to open mine eyes to see it or mine ears to hear it, to be surely and certainly grounded and established upon the very true word of God. Yet, for lack of grace, I have most wilfully and obstinately suffered myself to fall to such blindness that I have not only thought that the Bishop of Rome hath been and ought to be taken the chief and supreme head of the universal Church of Christ here on earth, but also, like no true subject, concealed and favoured such as I have known or thought to be of that opinion. For the which most detestable treasons and untruths, I here most humbly and with all my heart, first of all, ask of the King's Majesty forgiveness, and secondarily of the world, beseeching all these that either now do or hereafter shall hear of these my great transgressions, to take this, mine example, for an instruction for them to call for grace, that they thereby be stayed from falling at any time into such miserable blindness and folly. Moreover, here afore God and you, good Christian people, I do utterly and with all my heart recant and revoke all mine aforesaid erroneous and traitorous opinions. And as my conscience now doth force, I protest that, even with my heart, I firmly think and undoubtedly believe that the Bishop of Rome neither now hath, nor at any time hath had or can have, by any law of God or man, any more authority without the precinct of his own country about him than any other bishop hath within his own diocese. Whereby I assuredly take the abolishing of the pretensed and usurped power or authority of the Bishop of Rome out of this realm, to be done justly and truly by the law of God. And also, I take our Sovereign Lord, the King's Highness, to be supreme head, immediately next under Christ, of the Church of England and Ireland, and all other His Grace's dominions, both of the spirituality and temporality. And I confess not only that His Majesty is so by the law of God, but also His progenitors, kings of this realm, so have been, and His Highness's heirs and successors, kings of this realm, so shall be. Thus have I showed you my mind as well as I can, but neither so well as I would, nor so fully as I should, namely concerning the multitude of mercy which my most gracious prince hath showed toward me, not only for saving my body after worthy condemnation to death, as is aforesaid, but also for saving my soul from perishing, if my body had perished before the receiving of such wholesome counsel as I had at His Highness's most charitable assignment. And of this confession declared unto you, I say, as far forth as I can, heartily pray you all to bear me record, and most entirely to pray Almighty God for the long and most prosperous estate of our Sovereign Lord, the King's Majesty, in all his affairs and proceedings. By me, John Heywood.